From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress and model Isabella Rossellini. We'll talk about her celebrated parents, movie star Ingrid Bergman and Italian director Roberto Rossellini. About her long contract with Lancôme Cosmetics, which was terminated when she was in her early 40s. And her starring role in Blue Velvet. Isabella Rossellini has written a new memoir called Some of Me. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD of Herbie Nichols' compositions, interpreted by guitarist Duck Baker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Isabella Rossellini knows she means different things to different people. She says to people 60 and over, she's the daughter of movie star Ingrid Bergman. To film scholars, she's the daughter of Italian director Roberto Rossellini. People in their 30s know her as the star of Blue Velvet. Women of different generations know her as the former model for Lancôme Cosmetics. Isabella Rossellini writes about those different facets of her life in her new memoir, Some of Me. When she was growing up, her mother was virtually exiled from Hollywood. Ingrid Bergman had fallen in love with Roberto Rossellini while she was married to another man. She'd filed for divorce, and while she was waiting for it to come through, she became pregnant with a son conceived with Rossellini. This caused a great scandal. I asked Isabella Rossellini if she understood why this turned her mother into an outcast in Hollywood.
Well, were you still doing it in America? It's pretty scandalous to me that people are persecuted. Politicians, military people are persecuted on the basis that my mother was persecuted 50 years ago. And often in interviews, people say it's inconceivable nowadays to think what has happened to my mother. It's happening every day. People's lives are ruined because they fell in love with someone else when they were married, or they had an affair years before. You know, all human mistakes that everybody could make.
This is a very good point. How did your mother describe to you the morals charges against her, you know, in Hollywood? You know, what people held against her. Did she explain that to you when you were young?
You know, she never said, I got to tell you something. We sat at the table and she announced it to me. She wrote an autobiography, and at the time that she was writing it, she went back to looking at some of the letters she had received and some of the article that came out, and I think that came back fresh in her memory. So in that time, we talked more about it. I think she was very hurt by it, and I think she remained hurt throughout her life, and a great fear of a witch hunt.
One of the things that I learned about from your new book, Some of Me, is that when you were young, you had scoliosis, a curvature of the spine, and yours was pretty severe.
Yes.
So you had surgery in which, 13 vertebrae were fused?
Exactly.
Do I have that right? And you were, yes, in a body cast for, about 6 months?
For about 2 years.
2 years, my goodness.
Yes.
How did you spend your time when you were in the body cast?
Well, most of the time you're very sick, so most of the time you're just trying to, you can't do much if you are in pain, you know, just sit there and wait till the pain subsides. And then occasionally I felt better, and then I tried as much as I could to go to school, take walks, have a regular life, but obviously it was incredibly disruptive. But I think the hardest part of it was the pain. The pain, everything else you could deal with. You know, I was a teenager and I was embarrassed to have a body cast. I was embarrassed to be labeled deformed, but because that's what the scoliosis is. But those all seem to be not major problem. Really, the great problem is great physical pain. That is really hard. And I don't have any solution for it. I'm glad that I'm over it.
How long did the pain last?
The pain lasts for periods, depending on the operation. And now they don't do that procedures anymore. if you have a scoliosis now, there you are either in a brace for until you're completely grown, or they operate. But now they've found a metal leak that they can use and the body doesn't reject. But at the time I did my operation, they used bone from my leg to fuse my vertebra so that there would be no problem of rejection. But in order for the bone to fuse together, I had to be immobilized for 6 months and then also had cast. The operation was very painful. The stretching and the correction of the spine, which is now done while you're asleep and with these rods, metal rods, were done instead where you awake on a, and they literally stretched you like the medieval torture. And that was very painful. And that pain stayed for a long time because the cast was much bigger than I. So it would pressure. I had a machine in my mouth because the pressure was so strong beneath, underneath my chin and on my hips that my teeth could go back in my jaws. So I had a machine to keep my jaw separated. But still the pressure on the jaw was great. So it took days before my body gave in to that length.
I think what's so interesting about what you went through when you were young is that, you know, you, as an adult, you were, you've been an internationally acclaimed beauty. And it must have been so odd for you to go from thinking of yourself as deformed to thinking of yourself as beautiful, or to realize other people thought of you as beautiful.
Yeah, that was kind of, it was wonderful. You know, I remember keep on sending postcards to my doctor saying, can you imagine? it was pretty wonderful to have overcome all the odds.
Was it important to you to be beautiful? Your mother was beautiful. You probably had a pretty insecure self-image when you were young because of the scoliosis and the surgery.
But not so much. You know, I think one thing is to do, I don't know, I can't really, I don't remember being young and wondering if I was beautiful or not beautiful and terribly concerned about that. I don't remember even in my old age being very concerned about it. I don't know if it is wisdom or if I'm spoiled. Maybe people did tell me, you look so pretty. So I thought, oh, well, then I don't have to worry about that. So I don't know. I don't remember it as being an obsession. When I had scoliosis, I didn't think of myself as ugly. I thought of myself as deformed, as having a deformed spine, which is different, you know, and trying to be well and trying to walk. I couldn't walk because I'd lost the ability to walk. The stake was so much higher than just look pretty.
Right, right. How did you start modeling?
I started modeling by chance. I was 28, and I used to work for the Italian television. I'm Italian originally, but I lived in New York. And I socially, I've met a wonderful photographer called Bruce Weber, who wanted to photograph me. And I thought, oh, that'd be fun, so I can maybe buy the issue of that magazine all done up and save it to show it to my grandchildren. And I'll be an old bag and say, look, I looked pretty. I was photographed once. But then from Bruce's photo, I really literally had an overnight success. And within a month, I was in Richard Avedon's studio working basically every day, having covers. And my life completely changed. And I became a model and learned to love it.
You've been photographed by many great photographers. What are some of the different ways they get you to respond to the camera? Do you feel like you respond to the camera differently depending on who the photographer is?
Oh, definitely. There is a definitely style of posing. I have seen very, very beautiful girl who didn't have a great career, and somebody else who maybe was a little bit, they're always beautiful. The common denominator among models is they are beautiful, but some of them are odd-looking, or there is something strange and not classical beauty, and yet they have bigger careers just because there is an art in modeling. There is a know-how, and the style of posing also slightly changes with a different photographer. It can be more emphatic and artificial, or it can be real and real acting. And you learn that as you go along and do it.
Are there things that photographers would actually tell you to do or tell you to think about that would help?
Well, in my book, I give the example with Richard Avedon. He was the first one. See, I was terribly spoiled. My first experience was with Bruce Weber, followed by Richard Avedon, and they taught me. I think I couldn't have had a better school. I remember when I was posing, I thought I just had to be obedient and wear the clothes and make sure I wasn't going to wrinkle them up and mess them up. and I sat there and just obediently just wait for every instruction, turn a little bit left, turn a little bit right, look up, look down, and I just obeyed. And Avedon would just look at me and say, "What? Can you think of something?" And then when I thought of something, he'd say, "No, change your thought. I don't like what you're thinking." And one day I said, "What is it saying? He doesn't know what I'm thinking." So I went back to a thought I had, and he caught me immediately. He said, no, I told you, I don't like what you're thinking. Change your thought." And I think you could, if you concentrate, there is something that emanates through you. And that's what the great photographer photographs. The fact that you're, you know, Diana Vreeland, I quote in my book saying, there is no beauty without emotion. And I think that that's what is the responsibility of a model. It isn't so much to look beautiful. That mostly is genetic. You know, you're born like that. But you have to show your emotions. And that's what makes a great photo.
Now, is this something you think about when you're making movies, too?
Yes, it is. That's why I always say that it isn't, you know, people always differentiate between the two jobs as being so categorically different, modeling and acting. And they are, instead, there's a lot of it in common. What you don't have in common is that you don't have a dialogue when you're a model. You don't have to react to another actor. Sometimes you react to the photographer in the same way an actor would respond to the partner in front of. So, but you know, there are a lot of similarities in terms of the feeling that rises from within and changes your expression in your face, in your eyes. That is exactly the same for modeling and acting. But acting probably is a little bit more complex because a storytelling, there is an evolution of emotion that you have to have, and you have to do them in a certain order that people realize that from upset you get happy. And how do you get to from this to that? In modeling, you don't have to do the range, the arc. You just have to show the emotion right then and then. So it's probably simpler, but it is very similar.
My guest is actress and model Isabella Rossellini. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress and model Isabella Rossellini, and she's written a new memoir called Some of Me, as opposed to All of Me.
Exactly. It's not all of me, just a little bit of me.
Now, I found it interesting, before you started modeling professionally, you say you wore very little makeup.
Yes, I still do.
Why?
I guess I grew up like that. You know, nobody in my family used much makeup, and then you use so much makeup when you work, you know, that partially is maybe that. And you have made up with such great makeup artist that you can never mimic the result of makeup done by these great professionals. I enjoy makeup. I mean, it's definitely a great tool for my work, not only as a model, but also as an actress. I often used makeup and clothes to create characters, whether it was Dorothy Valance in Blue Velvet, or maybe the most, extreme, it was Perdita Durango in Wild at Heart, where I just had one scene, and I've used completely my ability of model and body appearance and body language to convey a character. And I think I did, because in one scene, I think people did have a precise idea who Perdita Durango was.
Once you started modeling for Lancôme, you had a contract that stipulated you had to wear makeup for public appearances.
Yes. Well, obviously, I think they're right. You know, you have to celebrate and support what you represent.
What else did the contract say?
Well, the contract, I think the oddest part of the contract is the moral stipulation, you know, that if I was involved in any scandal, they could get rid of me, which reminded me of the contract in the 40s that actors and actresses had with the studios. And they were similar that way. There were many, many similarities. The idea that a studio then, or a company now, it works as a Pygmalion. They create you. So you have to obey to that image, to that persona that they have created. Even in modeling now, there is a greater liberalization. But when I signed the contract, which was almost, now it's almost 17 years ago, still the moral stipulation was still in.
No, another stipulation that was in, I don't know if it's still in today in contracts, is that you weren't allowed to gain weight.
Oh, well, that's obvious, yes.
Right.
But that's obvious because you have to, they have to use your image and you become like a label. So you can't change too much. You also stipulated it. I couldn't change hair color or hairdo, or that I have at least to have their approval. And it's understandable. You have to create a certain continuity.
Did food become a big issue for you during those years?
No, it didn't, because I never was an anorexic model. I always said I was the fattest, shortest, oldest of the models. So I was pretty much my weight. I just watched not to become too fat, and that was it.
Now, with the morals clause, when you made Blue Velvet, and especially when you were nude in a scene in Blue Velvet, did Lancôme object to that? Blue Velvet's a very kinky, weird film.
Lancôme is a big entity. You know, it's many, many people. And some people were shocked by the film, as the general audience was. And some people loved the film, as some member of the general audience were too. So there was the same debate that was in the magazines and in the paper. It was within Lancôme. But I guess that the film was successful and the film was recognized as an artistic film. And then Lancôme became quite pleased that I wasn't just, I think in a way, for me, having been an actress and having done other things than just Lancôme, helped me maintain my contract for 14 years. Generally, the model to have the big contract, you get a big salary, so you don't have to work if you don't want to work. But then the company gets tired of you. They look and they say, well, there's another girl that seems more appealing. And generally, they don't stay more than 3, 4, 5 years. But I loved my work, and I wanted to continue it. And I just did it. And I think it helped Lancôme. They kept them being interested on me, seeing many facets and other aspect of me.
What about having a child without being married? How did they react to that?
Well, they didn't like that so much, but then they had to live with it, because I'm tough, you know? I assert my freedom very strongly, so they understood that at the beginning.
You were how old when you lost the contract with Lancôme?
42.
And it was because of your age?
Yes, it was because of my age. I mean, it was a very long debate. You know, it didn't happen all of a sudden. There is, you know, and I feel bad that Lancôme is nowadays the one that has been accused of having not kept me, even if we had an enormously successful campaign. But the truth of the matter is that any fashion magazine or any film, any woman that he's represented as beautiful, appealing, it's between 16 and 32. So Lancôme actually did keep me until I was 42. And there was an enormous debate within the company whether to keep me or not, until they just succumbed to the tradition. And they, in spite of my protesting, but it's their freedom. And I guess freedom is more to be respected. So I do respect their choices. I do still think that we lost an opportunity to break a prejudice, because I do believe that it is a prejudice not to use older women to represent elegance.
On a real practical level, older women buy their share of cosmetics and they want to see them displayed on somebody who is a mature woman, not someone in their 20s.
Well,
there's no way you're going to look like that.
Well, that is their point. The point is that when you do a campaign, you represent the dream in people. You do not represent the reality in people. Mm-hmm. And they believe that the dream of women is to stay young. So they take the symbol of youth. They take somebody who's not terribly young, because then you will feel terribly alienated. It's very interesting. You see, the people that do the cosmetic campaign, the big cosmetic campaign, are generally on their late 20s or early 30s. They're generally brunettes instead of blondes, because brunettes are more accessible and people can identify. But still, they have to be young enough to represent a sort of a dream and what you wish to be. My point with Lancôme is that the new generation of women, the biggest dream isn't to stay young, is to be independent, to be free, to be powerful, to do what you like to do, to assert yourself. But they considered that too avant-garde. It's not that they didn't recognize it. They said, yes, but we still think it's a minority of women that has those values, and that the biggest group of women dream to stay young. That's why plastic surgeons are so successful, right. I guess. So they had a valid point, and they're there to sell cream, not to do a social battle.
What was your mother, Ingrid Bergman's, attitude toward getting older, toward having wrinkles on her face? Did that bother her?
I don't remember ever discussing that with my mother, and I don't think she was very affected by it. But then one day I spoke to my stepfather, who said, oh, Mama, you know, she was kind of worried about that. And it surprised me, you know. Then I said, well, obviously, she must have been to a certain extent. She was an actress. She must have worked less. But I don't know that it was a great obsession. In my book, I imagine a conversation with my parents. Unfortunately, I lost both of them in my 20s. And if you want, I can read you some.
Sure.
I asked my mother, I asked my mother, you know, the Isabella, Mama, you were told you were beautiful. Mother, oh yes, many times. I felt a bit embarrassed about it. I never knew what to say and what to do. Then I found the answer when they said, Miss Bergman, you look so beautiful. I say, isn't it lucky? And felt that with that response, I had killed the subject and we could move on. And then it's me again. And when they stopped saying it and you were just told you looked old, and then how beautiful you had been, Mother. I wasn't told that to my face, but behind my back. Isabella, but whatever. But did it hurt you? Did you feel bad about getting older? And Mother said, why can I tell you? I didn't particularly like it, but the alternative, dying young, seemed a much worse destiny. That's what I made my mother answer.
So this is an imaginary conversation.
It's an imaginary conversation, but I think she would answer that.
Isabella Rossellini has written a new memoir called Some of Me. She'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Isabella Rossellini and talk about her starring role in Blue Velvet as a mysterious nightclub singer in a sadomasochistic relationship. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new recording by guitarist Duck Baker of compositions by pianist Herbie Nichols. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actress and model Isabella Rossellini. She's written a new memoir called Some of Me. Rossellini grew up in Rome and Paris and moved to New York at the age of 19. She didn't become a model until she was 28, and it was only after she established herself as a model that she started making movies. How much of an emphasis on acting have you wanted to have in your career?
I guess when I was a teenager, I wanted to do something different than acting, because not only my mother was such a great established actress and adored, but everybody else in my family was very successful, including my father, who was a great filmmaker. And then when I became a model, I thought there must have been some similarities with acting, and I became curious about acting. I kind of loved modeling unexpectedly, because I thought, like everybody else, that it was a stupid job. I had this stereotype in my head. So then I tentatively started to take classes and then I got some parts and had the courage to do them, which isn't easy when you come from a family that has been so glorified in films. I like acting, but I think I like it somewhat less than my mother. My mother just adored it, lived for it. And I don't. I like it. I like it a lot, but I don't have the same. I think my mother liked acting most and above all.
Well,
Nino.
you grew up around people who were obsessed with work. I mean, your father, your mother, you've been married to people who've been obsessed with work. Do you wish you had that obsession, or are you glad to not have it?
Now I'm glad not to have it. For many years, I felt diminished by not having that same passion, because I thought that passion corresponded to the amount of talent you had. And still today, I have to say, when I see the ability, then a passion for film or passion for writing or passion for something, that you can completely be absorbed by it. There is something incredibly enviable. And yet, I have my children, and I'm really glad now not to have that obsession. And if I have to pay it by having less talent, well, then I'd rather have less talent but be with my children.
I want to ask you about Blue Velvet. You were so wonderful in that film.
Thank you.
You played a nightclub singer who is exotic and mesmerizing, but is in a weird and abusive relationship with a psycho played by Dennis Hopper.
Yes.
How did you get the part, and what interested you in this part?
To me, it was the only time that I could portray a battered woman and a Stockholm syndrome, where it's very hard for a victim to recognize that they're a victim. Generally, a victim feels guilty, and does anything to please the person who's torturing them. And it's an absolute strange twist that our mind gives us. And you know, it is a recognized syndrome on kidnapped people or raped victims. And I thought it was quite interesting to play that part, and that what appealed me for the role. It was a wonderful way to portray sexuality and the darkness of it. And I played a femme fatale that was femme fatale just because she was kind of beautiful and she was singing and she had the features of somebody beautiful, but yet she was completely destroyed inside. And that was a pretty good role, you know. Most of the time, the femme fatales are portrayed as women who know exactly what they want and completely. And sex is portrayed as something that you go out there and choose for yourself. But we know that the reality is often we just have to, it just happens to us, and then we don't know what to do with it, what to make of it.
I'd like to play an excerpt of a scene that you had with a young man played by Kyle MacLachlan. And then in this scene, he's trying to solve the mystery of who you are and who Frank, the Dennis Hopper character, is. In this scene, you're being very seductive. You're trying to seduce him.
Do you like the way I feel?
Yes.
Feel me.
Hit me. Hit me. Hit me.
Isabella Rossellini, did you understand why this character asks to be hit?
Yes, I do, because I once was beaten, and I remembered when I played that part, and I had to say that line, beat me, I say, why would this woman want to be beaten? And then I remember that the time that it happened to me that I was beaten, the first blow to my head, and you just see little stars, exactly like Donald Duck. And there was a sense of bewilderment, and you don't know where you are. But I wasn't panicked. I wasn't anything. I just was bewildered, a strange feeling. And I thought that this woman, who had so many torments in her mind, became the victim of the abuse that she... Because she was raped and beaten by the character of Dennis Hopper, so that when she did get the first blow, the first punch, she would see the star, and her tormented thoughts could stop. And that's why she asked to be beaten.
Oh, what an interesting way of looking at it. Who beat you?
I don't want to give the details of all that. I don't want to start, you know, being oh, poor me. It happened, but I'm fine now.
Fine, okay. Now, an interesting thing you say about making this movie in your memoir is that when you were rehearsing, you didn't have to wear the makeup, you didn't have to wear the clothes, but you had to have the red fingernail polish on. Otherwise, you just couldn't do the part. Why is that?
Well, I think that because... a lot of the scenes were nude and a lot of the scenes were rape and a lot of it was very vulnerable. It was easier for me to play Dorothy, to be someone else. And so even when we rehearsed, since Dorothy used a lot of makeup, because I think Dorothy was covering herself up, she used makeup like a mask to mask her, the troubled inside, to make her... the lips perfectly red and the eyeshadows perfectly blue. Everything was to mask the fact that she was completely destroyed. So I needed my red nail polish as my hands flew in front of me to give me that sense of cover-up that she was so desperately trying to give. And if I would see my hand not made up, it would be Isabella's hand and I couldn't be Dorothy.
Right. Now, what do you do when you're shooting the scenes with Dennis Hopper, say the scenes where he's raping you and inhaling this weird in this weird gas that he inhales that turns him on? What do you do in a scene like that to break the tension?
Well, Dennis was wonderful. You know, that was the first scene I have done in the film. I just came, the film had started, I think, a week or two. And we came in, and David said, you know, we're going to start with that scene because that scene otherwise we'll always be thinking about it. We'll always be worrying about it. So we'll do it on the first day so we get it over with. And I couldn't believe that I had to be in front of Dennis Hopper naked and say all this weird thing. I was agonizing. And I asked, I left a little message to Dennis' room saying, can I have breakfast with you? I've never met the man, just to have to get to know him a little bit. And he came very annoyed, but that, you know, what do you want, to become friends to do that? And he was right, you know, you are acting, you don't have to be friends. But then Dennis and David were so wonderfully protective of me and so wonderfully comical too, that they really released attention, and it was wonderful to work with them.
There's a scene in the movie where you're wandering around the street naked. Tell me about that scene and what you wanted your body to look at. It's not a vanity scene.
No, not at all. I mean, it's not at all. David Lynch told me that when he was a child, coming back from school, he saw a naked woman walking in the street. And instead of getting aroused or excited at that sight, he started to cry. It terrified him. And he wanted to convey the same terror. He wanted Dorothy to walk in the street of Wilmington, where we shot the film, naked, and convey the same sense of terror instead of the sense of sex appeal. And when he was talking to me, there was a photo of Nick Ott that I remembered. And it was a photo of a young girl in Vietnam. She has been a victim of Nepal attack, and her clothes have been completely torn off the body, and she has skin hanging, and she's completely naked, and she walks in the street with the arms outstretched, and it's such a helpless gesture. And I couldn't think of anything else that his absolute helpless gesture and walking like that, if I would have walked covering my breast or covering myself, it meant that Dorothy still had some sense of pride, still had something in her to protect her. That woman had to have lost everything, and so she had to walk completely exposed, just saying, help me. And that photo is the photo. I took the gesture from that photo and used it. And I hope that I conveyed the same sense of despair. I wanted to be like raw meat. You know, my nudity, it was like raw meat, like a butcher, like walking in a butcher and see a cow hanging, you know, a quarter of a cow hanging. That was the thing that I wanted to convey.
Seems to me you really have a very analytical approach to acting. No, I mean that you really kind of think it through on many levels.
Well, I do, you know. I don't know. I can't tell. But this is the way I do it. I don't know if it is more or less analytical than others.
Isabella Rossellini is my guest, and she has a new memoir called Some of Me. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh
Thank
Air. Back with actress and model Isabella Rossellini. She has a new memoir called Some of Me. When you were growing up with your parents, Ingrid Bergman, and the film director, Roberto Rossellini, did you love movies? Were movies a big part of your life?
Not very much. Strange enough, no, they weren't. My father and mother were very, very interested in other things, in films as well, but a lot of other things, especially my father. And I've always assumed that any director would be interested in politics, in religion, in any science, in any other subject where they would get inspiration to do their films. It was only later in life that I discovered that often directors are just film buffs. They don't know anything else but films. That was very surprising to me.
When did you realize how much you looked like your mother? And I don't know if you agree with everybody who says that you do, but I surely think
yes,
there's a really strong...
They said a lot, yes. I write it in my book about it because I always thought, oh, people exaggerate, it's not true. And then my mother noticed it. My mother saw me once on television when I was working as a journalist, and she said, you know, I see it on... I don't see it in life, but see it when you appeared on television. We move the same. It isn't only that we have similar features, but there is something in the voice and in the way we moved. And I said, no, mother, you're wrong. I don't think so. I think you're wrong. So I was the last one to be convinced. And then one day I walked into an antique shop, and there were beautiful things, tables and chairs and old mirrors. And I was walking, and a middle-aged woman came in, quite elegant, but she looked very reserved. So every time I walked toward her, you know, I discreetly walked the opposite way so I wouldn't disturb her until I bumped into her. And as I was walking, though, I kept on saying, she reminds me of my mother. She reminds me of my mother. And then when I bumped into her, I looked up and it was myself. I had not recognized. It was the reflection of me in the mirror. I had not recognized myself because I didn't realize I'd grown so old. And then I said, but I did say to myself, she reminds me of my mother. And it was me. Mm-hmm. So that's when I thought, well, people are right. I do look like her.
You write in your memoir that your mother came out of Hollywood and she had, you know, a Hollywood sense of entertainment. She liked entertainment. Whereas your father, the famous neorealist director, had a much more kind of serious artistic approach to movies. Do you feel that you grew up, and that he didn't care much about, quote, light entertainment, do you feel that you grew up with an integrated sense of both, you know, film as a higher art and as an entertainment?
I think so. I think I'm more indulgent to, you know, if I see a film that it's silly, but I have enjoyed looking at it, I praise it. And as I praised films that make me think or make me cry. And yet, I still am convinced that when you are... See, my father was really a filmmaker that innovated cinema. He had to be completely... I think you need that energy of faith and the absolute belief in your ideas. If you are like me, too democratic and too open, I don't think you can assert yourself or you can break grounds. You know, often I found out that the great artists or the people that really are breaking grounds, they are pretty obsessive. Not all of them, but some of them.
Right, right. Well, you know, I should say you lived with at least one very obsessive director. You were married to Martin Scorsese for two or three years. And I'm wondering if you ever wanted to be in his movies while you were together.
When we were married, I wasn't an actress, so
Before you started acting.
Yes, it was before I started acting. And then we've talked about, I would love to work with Marty. It would be fantastic. But we never really had an opportunity. We never had the right role that I could play.
Do you think that having an accent, which sounds kind of European but also vaguely Swedish, do you think having an accent has affected your film career in America?
I think it does to a certain extent. It does, because it limits the role that you can play. If they want a very American character, or if the writer or the director always conceived of that person to be American, it's hard for them then to have a foreigner. They always think that if a foreign live in a country, how do you have to justify it? Or would she change? Would she be lost? What happened to her family? You know, there are consequences to a character. It can't be a housewife from very adjusted to the life in the neighborhood. If you're a foreigner, you bring in a certain amount of exotism. So in a way, it limits your career. On the other hand, it helped me because I do Dutch film, I do French film, I do Italian film, and I love the variety. And accent, I've tried very much to camouflage my accent with other accent. I was unable to erase my accent and speak with English perfectly well. In films, I had German accent, Hungarian, Russian, Italian, French. So with that device, I was able to at least play different nationality.
We're going to end this interview with you singing Blue Velvet.
I thought right now. I thought taped.
Taped. Have you sung much outside of this film?
No, I haven't. I loved it. I loved singing for Blue Velvet.
Yeah, you sang really well. Very, very nice.
Thank you. Yeah. But... No, I wish I could. I did do a record lately. A group called Tender Sticks asked me. I did a song with them. They wanted it's a love story of a singer who falls in love with an actress, and so I played the actress, and I have to sing badly, like an actress would sing, more with voice and mood than a real ability of singing, and that was fun to do. I wish I could do more. I wish I had a better voice so I could do more singing.
Well, I like your voice. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Isabella Rossellini's new memoir is called Some of Me.
She
coming up, the compositions of pianist Herbie Nichols revived by guitarist Duck Baker. This is Fresh Air. Pianist Herbie Nichols was a brilliant jazz composer whose tunes are slowly coming back into the jazz repertoire 40 years after he recorded them. Duck Baker is a finger-picking acoustic guitarist whose recordings include free improvisations with fellow guitarist Henry Kaiser and solo versions of jazz compositions by Duke Ellington and the South African pianist Abdullah Ibrahim. Now Baker has a CD playing Herbie Nichols pieces. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
That's House Party Starting by pianist Herbie Nichols from Duck Baker's CD Spinning Song. There is a small tradition of playing piano rags on guitar, and the rhythms of 1920s stride pianists like Fats Waller have left their mark on blues and jazz guitar finger-picking patterns. Not that it's easy to translate keyboard music to the fretboard. Melodies, chords, and bass lines spread out all over the ivories have to be compressed into the space of two octaves, and often those chords have to be simplified. Baker is as good at adapting piano music to guitar as anybody, but Nichols' puzzling chords and little sprays of notes for atmospheric effect become, well, impossible. Any guitarist would know better. But when record producer and non-guitarist John Zorn suggested the idea, Baker figured, why not? Here's Herbie Nichols and then Duck Baker playing The Third World. The first thing you notice about the guitar version is that the tempo is much slower and not so steady. Duck Baker sounds like he's struggling, but he doesn't give up easily. He gets better marks on the comparison test for 2300 Skidoo. It's a little unfair to make these comparisons. Like a movie adapted from a book, these guitar arrangements should be judged on their own terms. One nice thing about them is, Duck Baker makes connections and allusions that have little to do with Herbie Nichols, but a lot to do with guitar traditions. He bends strings like a blues man, and gives a few notes heavy vibrato like gypsy guitarist Django Reinhardt. This is Lady Sings the Blues, a tune already adapted 40 years ago, when Billie Holiday rewrote the bridge and put lyrics to it. ¶¶ Duck Baker's liner notes to his CD Spinning Song make some astute points about the harmonic logic of Herbie Nichols' compositions, hoping to get jazz musicians to check them out. That's good advice for sure, and more musicians are discovering these pieces 3 decades after Nichols' death. For that, give credit to industrious advocates like trombonist Roswell Rudd, pianist Misha Mengelberg, bassist Buell Neidlinger, and Duck Baker.
Kevin Whitehead is currently in Amsterdam. He reviewed Spinning Song, a collection of Herbie Nichols compositions recorded by guitarist Duck Baker. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Joan Tui Westman. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Audrey Bentham, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.